Welcome to the Bob Davis Podcast's The New Talk. This is podcast 580. Back in the studio, after an evening of driving around in the slipping and the sliding and the snow, it is late at night, and it's time to get the Bob Davis Podcast radio show up for the week and for the weekend. So this is going to be Bob Davis Podcast radio show number 56, and we're just going to start with segment one. Welcome to the Bob Davis Podcasts radio show. For all the podcasts, visit thebobdavispodcasts.com. So in this show, we're going to talk about fake news again, an electoral crisis, infrastructure and government spending, and maybe some stuff up at the end of the show in the last segment. So I've been doing this radio show now for a little more than a year, and originally I intended it as a way to put content from the Bob Davis Podcasts on the radio. Then I started to post this radio show on thebobdavispodcast.com. You can always hear the show on thebobdavispodcast.com before it airs for a couple of reasons. One, the audio quality of a couple of places where it shows up, and in particular on the radio, isn't as good as it is on the podcasts. And so what's happened is, because I do so many podcasts, I don't want to have the radio show every week be a rehash of what I've already done in terms of podcasts. So now I'm starting to put original content in the radio show every week. And because of the nature of talk radio audiences, I've started moving a lot of my hard political content to the radio show. And the truth of the matter is that I find a lot of the news that I am interested in when it comes to politics provides little endpoint for me to actually talk about that stuff on the air, because I have a real desire to talk about new things or to talk about new trends in society and culture a little bit more in depth than what I might have talked about on the radio 10 years ago, let's say. Because I think we actually need to move beyond the day-to-day reactionary stuff. Now, if you've been listening, I've been talking about this for quite some time, because I believe it isn't so much our poisoned political sphere in the media. I think we, as human beings, need to change in this country. And I'm not saying change our politics. I'm saying change how we think and talk about politics so that we actually can influence what is needed in our structures politically for the future. Because right now, all we're doing is arguing back and forth. And we will return to this theme later in the show. Now, because of the recent election, many people have very high expectations one way or the other regarding the president-elect. Most of these people are going to be let down when he finally gets inaugurated and starts doing things. And without getting into too many details, many of the appointees are either straight-up moderates or establishment figures, or not necessarily what their rhetoric promises. And sometimes that's good, but generally, in terms of expectations, it's not good. Trump's ideas are actually all over the road, philosophically speaking. In some ways, he's just as much of a statist as Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama or, you know, John Boehner, that everyone just couldn't stand. One example is his penchant for infrastructure, rebuilding roads and bridges, airports, and other public facilities. We'll talk about that. And then you get all this arguing about appointees, and we're sitting on the edge of our seats over every single statement from Trump Tower. We're fighting about the campaign and today's latest tweet, and all of this accomplishes nothing. The president-elect generally, in my opinion, deserves whatever appointments he makes. Now, sometimes when a new president that you don't like becomes president, then you don't want him to have his appointments, but, you know, it's his cabinet for the most part. The Senate, of course, advises and consents on certain positions, others not so much, but I would say generally when you elect a president, they should probably get the people that they want to get, unless there is some major legal or mitigating reason not to confirm someone. Even with Democrats threatening to shut down the government, which is an interesting turn of events, Trump is probably going to get most of his appointments through the Senate, but a few are not going to make it. Couldn't tell you how many will or won't, but let's wait and see what Trump administration, what the makeup of the Trump administration is going to look like, and then we can start making some judgments about it, and we will be able to make more judgments about things when they actually start doing something. But things that people need to think about is, first of all, with an establishment Congress, expecting a reduction in the size, scope, and power of federal and state governments is probably unrealistic. People who expect a complete repeal of Obamacare might be a little disappointed. People who expect a reduction in federal spending might be a little disappointed. Sustained economic growth, because we're bringing manufacturing jobs back to the United States, might be a little difficult because of various reasons. Just because we're rebuilding airports or roads and bridges, we have unrealistic expectations of the results of these kinds of measures. We'll talk about that. The bottom line is, I'm not going to cheerlead for Trump. I'm not going to cheerlead for the Republican Party. If and when they do something good or something stupid, I will talk about it. Meanwhile, the quality and detail in our news media remains abysmal. For all the talk about fake news, whatever that is, and I would just say basically the false narrative that Russian propagandists influenced the outcome of the U.S. election, you know, for all of this, this week, the Washington Post had to post an editor's note to a story which purported to prove Russian involvement with a statement that said the paper could not prove the facts presented in the story. So you have a fake news story in the Washington Post that, in fact, may be fake. It just doesn't, you can't make this kind of stuff up, right? Most of what is written and broadcast is a narrative. I've said this many times. Usually it's a false narrative. That is, someone says something provocative or seeds a narrative, and writers, and I won't really even call them journalists, pick up the quote and write a couple of hundred words with it. Then that is then picked up and rewritten somewhere else and eventually presented as true because it's what? It's a news story. And then it runs its course and it starts all over again, as I have detailed in previous podcasts. Many of us have been watching Westworld. This is the human-like world where you have these androids that are controlled through software, which is uploaded to their processor brains. It's called storylines. That's what the software that makes them do things is called. This is art imitating life because this is the way we are controlled. We respond to storylines rather than actually think about what needs to be done and where we are headed. Reporters and journalists are not running down stories. They're writing their truth. They're writing copy around quotes. So we are reacting to these narratives, these storylines. And I'll talk again later in the show about what we have to do to combat this kind of media and this kind of storyline mind control or brainwashing that is going on in our society and throughout the world and on virtually every airwave that's available out there. Also, this narrative that somehow Hillary Clinton would have been elected except for fake news influencing voters needs to be addressed. I'll do that in this show because now the left wants something done, quote unquote, done about fake news. And that means somebody has to pass a law. Somebody has to enact some sort of policy that rates the news. Somebody has to do this, that, or the other thing, which essentially, in the end, competes with constitutional guarantees about our free speech. Finally, we have Jill Stein, who is continuing recount efforts, although she's starting to founder in courts in Pennsylvania and I think Wisconsin. I know Wisconsin refused to actually do a complete hand recount. They'll recount the machines, but they won't go through and do a hand recount. And the idea here is, I think they want to intimidate or otherwise influence people's perceptions of the legitimacy of the Trump presidency. But more importantly, what they're trying to do, and this may have nothing to do with the Jill Stein recount effort, but what they also want to do, and this is Clinton supporters, want to influence or intimidate electors to essentially delegitimize the Trump presidency, should it happen, or actually nominate in some way, shape, or form and get elected through Congress by throwing the election at Congress, someone like John Kasich. It's like science fiction. So that is what is going on. We'll talk about that stuff. So coming up in the next segment, we're going to talk about narratives and fake news again. It is everywhere. It's been everywhere for a week. Fake news is now this term that's starting to trend. So we got to talk about what we are supposed to do about it. And we'll talk about that in the next segment. So there is a lot to talk about. What I'd like to do is try not to get into so much reactive stuff, but talk about what kinds of issues we're going to be dealing with for the next few, at least the next 2 years coming up. For more of the Bob Davis podcasts, visit thebobdavispodcasts.com. For more of this show, visit thebobdavispodcast.com or gcnlive.com. This is the Bob Davis Podcasts radio show. Back in the studio just ahead of segment two for this week's Bob Davis Podcast radio show. You know, I've been following Brush Studio because they're obviously one of my clients on Instagram. And I noticed tonight they were they posted a picture of some folks having a really good time at Brush. And then this kind of went together in my head with the Canadian Pacific Holiday Train went by my house. I don't know if you've seen this or not, but it's a train that has all these lights on and it plays Christmas music. And it was, I assume that it was the Canadian Pacific's Christmas party or some crazy thing like that. And I thought that, you know, usually when I talk about Brush Studio, I talk about corporate meetings or I talk about client appreciation. But I didn't even think about Brush Studio for something like a Christmas party or for showing your appreciation to a specific group within your company by, you know, really having a fun night at Brush Studio in the West End in St. Louis Park. First of all, what is it? Well, what you do is you get a bunch of people together and you go to Brush Studio and an artist will guide all of your friends and people through a featured painting step by step. If you follow them on Instagram or check out their Facebook page, if you click on the link at the top of the Bob Davis Podcast page, it takes you to brushstudio.net, which is their website, shows you how the whole thing works. Why is it great? It's great because it's a whole participation thing. People are, you know, guided through a painting. It's not paint by numbers. They actually paint. And if you've seen some of the pictures, these are not trained artists. And that's what's really cool about it, because they come away with something that they will never, ever forget. So if you want to show one part of your company how much you appreciate them, yeah, you can take them to lunch or dinner or something like that. You can give them some gift. But something like this, an evening at Brush Studio, is something that they will remember forever. And you can socialize and bond with them, and they can socialize and bond with each other. Brush Studio events are held in a relaxed social setting. They are event planning ninjas. So here's what you do. First of all, check out the Brush Studio banner at the top of the Bob Davis Podcast page, or visit brushstudio.net. You can also contact them at 952-236-1700. That's 952-236-1700. They got tons of different choices when it comes to wine and beer, and all of their events are catered by Crave in the West End. And of course, they're in the West End, so there's always plenty of parking and it's easy to get to. Brush Studio and brushstudio.net. Check them out online. Again, you can contact them at 952-236-1700. That's 952-236-1700. Brush Studio. All right, here is segment two of this week's Bob Davis Podcast radio show. You're listening to the Bob Davis Podcasts radio show. To hear more of the Bob Davis Podcast, visit thebobdavispodcast.com. Welcome back. So this week I did a podcast about fake news and demands to do something about it. And I'm not going to go on for another 43 minutes in the radio show because there just isn't enough time. The term fake news now actually means something, and the term fake news is actually trending. So I figured out, and I think that there's probably a lot of people listening to the radio that really don't know what people mean when they say fake news. Now, originally, when I used the term, I used it to describe false narratives, which is another thing entirely. So what fake news is, it is a false story that is posted on reputable platforms where people purportedly don't know the story is fake. And then, so it starts out on Facebook or Twitter, and then it moves to Breitbart or Huffington, or it comes the other direction. And it ends up being a searchable item, and it comes up in Google searches once it's posted several times on Facebook or Twitter. And the idea is that people will talk about it, and then it sometimes becomes some kind of a narrative. Supporters of Hillary Clinton have now concluded that fake news influenced the outcome of the election in places like Ohio and Pennsylvania and Wisconsin. Now, first of all, they have no basis in fact for saying that, because the truth of the matter is we don't know what influenced the election. Yes, there are theories, and we are all entitled to our theories. Voting is done, though, through a secret ballot, and you can't go back and interview voters on why they voted the way they did, even if they knew when they voted. In other words, if you knew that Sally voted on such and such a date, you still couldn't find her ballot because a name is not attached to the ballot. So unless you interviewed Sally before she voted and after she voted and have her ballot, then, you know, the information is pretty much unreliable. The other tool that a lot of people use is exit polls, and exit polls are notoriously unreliable because they use small sample sizes. They're fine to provide color on election night to discuss things, but they don't really tell you how people voted. Now, political scientists have voter registrar data, they have voting data, they have, you know, the ability to sift through that data state by state, county by county, precinct by precinct, and they make conclusions about things, and they offer theories, then they test those theories in forums, they talk to other academics, they talk to people who work in campaigns and not on television, they talk to elected officials about what they did and why they did and what they said and so forth. And this is how they come to some conclusions about what influenced the election. The bottom line is it's going to be a long time before we have a clearer idea of what influenced voters in 2016. And most of the initial theories will be proven wrong. For example, you can't say things like women should have voted for Clinton, but they voted for Trump. Therefore, something's wrong with women because it is intellectually dishonest. And you don't know what happened and you don't know why it happened. People, despite conventional wisdom, don't always vote as blocks based on their race, creed, gender, or color. Now, Donald Trump won close popular vote contests in Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, Florida, and North Carolina, pivotal states in the electoral race for president in 2016. He won by a slightly higher margin, respectably, a respectable margin in Ohio. So the most you can say is Clinton voters simply did not show up in those states at the margin they did for the president in 2008 and 2012, meaning President Obama. My own pet theory is that Trump did not necessarily win the election so much in those states as Hillary Clinton actually lost it and thus lost the electoral race for president. And you can throw out any theory that you want as to why she lost it, but that's what happened. It's very similar in my mind to what happened to Mitt Romney in 2012. His voters simply did not show up. Obama won by thinner margins in 2012 than he did in 2008. But in 2016, Clinton could have won by the same razor-thin margins as Trump and or Obama in 2012, but she couldn't pull it off. Now, it's going to be a while before we fully understand why. It could have been the media telling her voters that she was going to win, you know, and so they stayed home. It could have been that they paid too much attention to those popular vote totals being broadcast all the time, the popular vote polls, and assumed that she was going to win. Or it could have been that they just didn't like her, or it could have been that they liked Trump, or it could have been any number of other things. I doubt it was any kind of fake news, but that doesn't stop her supporters from demanding that, quote unquote, something be done. So what happened this week and the last week, Facebook announced that they're going to be starting to provide controls. They want to rate content providers. Another story released says the big internet companies will start employing and sharing hashtags to denote content they delete so their competitors can do the same. Those two stories have been conflated. They are completely different issues. The alt-right community is all up in arms saying that they can suppress you in this way. They can turn you off on the internet. But in terms of the hashtags, most of this is directed at enforcing existing terms of service agreements with social media and search engines. The problem is, it is a slippery slope. Even with the longstanding discussion in defense and foreign policy circles of going after Islamic jihadist websites, we do have First Amendment free speech guarantees in the United States. So my bottom line on this is, You know, a private company can do whatever they want to do. If they want to impose controls, they can do it. But if they go too far, then they risk opening themselves up to First Amendment challenges, which could end up costing them a lot of money if people's rights are violated. The other thing is that there are tools that people can use, like VPNs, virtual private networks, and other kinds of tools to defeat algorithms or find alternative workarounds to whatever kind of, you know, soft censorship someone like Facebook, a company like Facebook may try to do. The fact is that Facebook caved to pressure from left-leaning groups, which have suddenly started making claims about fake news, which in fact are fake. They are false narratives, and they can't be substantiated. As I mentioned in the first segment, the Washington Post did a story this week that is, in fact, they had to disclaim as they published it, saying we can't prove the veracity of this statement. So the story on fake news is fake in itself. You know, as I said in the podcast, I do think that we as content providers need to be careful about propagating and reacting to false narratives and false news stories. And people need to be careful about what memes and videos they share, post, and like, not because we're worried about free speech, but because we're interested in the truth. We need to understand just reading the newspaper and watching the TV is not informing us, and most of us don't even do that. We get our news from Facebook, and it makes you a fool if you do that. We need context. We need to read and understand source material, and we need to read books, and not just the books that come out about politics, the books in our little political realm, the current event books, which are nothing better than tweets and Facebook posts, but books and things that maybe aren't necessarily political, history, particularly world history, technology, sociology, even novels. If we don't want to be influenced by these false narratives and literally fake news, we need to do what is necessary to be better citizens when it comes to liking and sharing and how we talk about politics. So we have to stop being partisans. We have to start thinking of our neighbors and people that disagree with us as human beings rather than a Republican knuckle dragger or, you know, a butterfly Democrat, you know, someone like that. And we have to realize also that not everything is a conspiracy. So think about that. So coming up in the next segment, now they're going after the electors. Is it sore loser syndrome or a strategy? This is the Bob Davis Podcasts radio show. I mentioned I was out in the slipping and sliding this evening. Beautiful white snow. It's that sugar kind of snow, kind of like powdered sugar everywhere, and it's cold. And of course, when it comes to keeping your heating systems up and running, you can't forget Ryan Plumbing and Heating of St. Paul for home or business. There's still time to get your heating checked to make sure everything works. It's great to come home. I turned the heat down, of course, before I left because I didn't want to waste, you know, gas. And when I got back in, I cranked up the heat, and it's great when you crank it up and it works, right? When it comes to keeping all of your systems running right, especially these days at home or your business, when you have plumbing or heating problems or air conditioning problems, especially for emergency service and for heating checks, which can still be done, don't forget Ryan Plumbing and Heating. Ryan Plumbing and Heating in St. Paul, 651-224-4771 in Minneapolis, 612-927-6488. RyanPlumbing.com online. I've told you all about how they go back four generations in St. Paul. What do they do? Quality replacement and repair of all plumbing, heating, and air conditioning systems, residential and business, and great emergency service. Ask Ryan about approving the efficiency of your heating system if they come in and check. If you do have the wherewithal to do it now and you can get them to do high efficiency heat, it will save you a lot of money over time. Once again, Ryan Plumbing and Heating in St. Paul, 651-224-4771 in Minneapolis, 612-927-6488. Metro wide from St. Paul. That means the suburbs too. For four generations, Ryan Plumbing and Heating. All right, here is segment three of this week's Bob Davis Podcast radio show. Bob Davis Podcast radio show. To sign up for the Bob Davis Podcast newsletter, The Bob Line, visit thebobdavispodcast.com. Well, I'm going to start by saying this is going to be kind of complicated, this segment. And if you're the kind of person that likes talk radio people that yell and scream and make it easy for you, I'm not that guy. So it's going to be hard to follow and it's going to be complicated, but I don't care. So we're going to start with the structure of the United States government. And I'm pretty sure most of the people listening, if they don't know by now, they know that the United States is a representative republic. Technically, academics refer to any participatory government as a democracy, but all democracies aren't created equal. So the United States federal system is unique in that individual states, and this is going to be some language that people may not like, but basically they share power with the federal government. And that's done through checks and balances between legislative, executive, and judicial powers. It's checks between the houses of government within the houses of government. It's checks at the federal and state level. It's the states checking the federal and the federal checking the state. And it's important not to forget local governments like towns and city councils, counties, townships, planning councils, and boards of education. This is the structure of our government in the United States. Most of these bodies are populated with elected members. And as a result, what we do in this country is we have a lot of elections. We have local and national elections all the time. We choose a new legislature every 2 years and new executives every 4, 1/3 of the Senate, and on and on and on. We elect judges or governors and presidents. We appoint judges. There's always something going on in the election world in politics. Upper houses advise and consent presidents and governors on their appointments and treaties and things of that nature, depending on what we're talking about. And the Electoral College is a part of this system. And this is a check for the states on the popular vote for president. The popular vote for president, of course, does not elect the president. The Electoral College elects the president. Aside from the fact that the founders feared mobs more than anything, the Electoral College also empowers the states, which constitutionally share power with the federal government. When I say share power, some people don't like that choice of words. It's not precisely accurate, but, it will do for this discussion. Now, for years, Hillary Clinton has advocated getting rid of the Electoral College. She also said in the debates that she would abide by the result of the election because she was confident that she would win. Democrats are generally in favor of what they call direct democracy, and that is directly electing the president. I am personally against direct democracy. I love the Electoral College. I think we have too much democracy in this country built onto the superstructure of a republic. I think senators should be appointed by state legislatures. I think judges should be appointed and not elected because this would make state legislatures more important than passing laws about pulling up your pants, and it would make governors more important than issuing proclamations. And as a result, people might actually start paying more attention and getting more involved in their local political platforms than they do. And I'm not talking about the platform. I mean the local political structures, state governments, and so forth. And I think presidential electors should be able to vote for anybody they want to be president. They're prevented from doing so by state law in some places, although no rogue elector has ever been prosecuted. This is where some Democrats and Clinton supporters are focusing an effort to deny Trump an electoral majority of 270 plus votes when the Electoral College meets to vote in their respective state capitals in the next week or so. Now, there have been reports that some electors have received death threats. I don't know if these are true. There have been an effort to influence these electors, which I don't think is a good idea. Most of the time, you're not supposed to even know who they are. Between socialist candidate Jill Stein's efforts at recounts, which is a waste of time, again designed to slow down the vote and thus delay certification of the electors, which some believe has to do with forcing the Supreme Court into the fight, which is just a fantasy because the Supreme Court is only 8 members, it would be divided and on and on and on. What happens if Trump, for some reason, doesn't have a majority? Well, it will go to the House for president and the Senate for vice president. It will go to the new House and the new Senate, which still have Republican majorities. So Trump and Pence would still be president. Now, there could be floor fights. Some say that the idea is that they have a floor fight and they force John Kasich in as president, which is silliness because the reality is nobody voted for John Kasich. They voted for Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton, and I think it would please no one. The main strategy here is to delegitimize a President Trump, giving the Democrats a clarion call for the next 4 years. And apparently Hillary still wants to run again in 2020. My sense is the recounts are going to go nowhere. There's already talk about recovering Jill Stein's donations because apparently she's not using them for the recount. And then I think there will be a pushback because of all this, because there's a lot of people who voted for Trump in states that he didn't win. And there's a lot of people that voted for Trump in states that he did win. And I think they're just going to look at it as sore loserism. The best bet Democrats have would be, in my view, to just let Trump be Trump and, you know, go back to the drawing board as far as opposing his policies and come up with some policies that they feel will actually work for the future and present them in the next two election cycles. And then they might have a better chance in 2020. But just as we saw with Republicans in 2008 and 2012, there are a lot of upset people who believe things don't make any sense and they've got to do whatever they can to try and stop this from happening and stop the Republican majority from doing what it wants to do. The thing that's amusing to me about it is somebody just posted a thing on Facebook the other day that said, how dare these Democrats do this? They're sore losers. And in fact, this is exactly what the Republicans did in 2008 and 2012. They used their ability to vote no on everything, the party of no, to essentially win state houses and legislatures and eventually to win the presidency in 2016. So how quickly we forget what the other side does when they are out of power. This is the nature of politics in the United States. And, you know, I'll talk about this, but there's lots of expectations about Trump coming from all kinds of different people for different reasons, expectations that are probably going to end in disappointment. There are some economic facts of life, which I'm going to talk about. I actually detailed them in the last show. I'm going to talk about them a little bit in this next segment. These are stubborn problems that can't be washed away with government spending or offering tax incentives to companies or tweets or whatever. And just as George Washington was reported to have said to John Adams, "I am fairly out and you are fairly in, and we will see which one of us is happier," I think Barack Obama is probably one of the happiest people here toward the end of his term. Washington hated being president. Most presidents do hate it by the time they get out because it is a political job. It's difficult because you have to work in an institution of the federal government that, again, shares power. It is checked by Congress, the courts, and the states, and often your biggest enemy turns out to be the people in your own political party. Just ask LBJ about that. That's why I tell people to watch that movie All the Way. So what am I going to talk about in the next segment? We've kind of dealt with this controversy about the Electoral College. I want to talk about Trump's economic plans because, you know, you hear these terms like conservative and liberal bantied about, and I'm not sure that Trump really fits into any of these pegs. Part of his big economic plan is to spend federal funds on infrastructure rebuilding. We're talking about roads and bridges that, quote, are falling down, and airports that, quote, look like they came from the third world. First of all, I've toured most of the country. I've been on many of the roads that he's talking about. I've been in a lot of airports. I've driven all over the country, and I'm going to talk a little bit about my observations on that. Secondly, where does the money come from for that kind of thing? And that's really the key question. How does this all work, economically speaking? Some people think it sounds great, but it's going to bring jobs back to the country. We're going to talk about that coming up in the next segment. The question is really, will it work next? For all the Bob Davis podcasts, visit the BobDavisPodcasts.com. If you want to hear more of this show, visit GCNLive.com. Don't forget to sign up for the Bob Davis Podcast newsletter when you visit the BobDavisPodcast.com. This is the Bob Davis Podcasts radio show.
Picking me up, instead you're dragging me.
just ahead of segment four of this week's Bob Davis Podcast Radio Show. Thanks once again to the digital sponsor, thebobdavispodcast.com. All these months, really more than a month, more than a year, I think, Alpha Systems for pilots. If you want to be safe on takeoffs and landings, Alpha Systems makes the revolutionary angle of attack indicator. The bottom line is Alpha Systems AOA saves lives. Without going into too much detail, it's simply a visual indicator of the lift that your wing is producing. It's critical on takeoffs and landings. Click on Alpha Systems in the banner there at the top of the Bob Davis Podcast page for more info about Alpha's revolutionary angle of attack indicator. Their motto is pilots fly safe, and Alpha Systems AOA saves lives. And thanks again, you guys, for sponsoring the Bob Davis Podcasts. Here is segment four of this week's Bob Davis Podcast Radio Show. You're listening to the Bob Davis Podcast Radio Show. Remember, for all the Bob Davis podcasts, visit thebobdavispodcast.com. Welcome back. Donald Trump has said he will make America great again. The people that voted for him apparently have taken him at his word. Making America great again involves fixing the economy and, quote, putting people back to work, among other things. How does he intend to do this? And this is probably one of the biggest expectations that needs to be discussed before anything even gets started. I'm going to summarize what I have learned about his economic plan. There are three legs to it, basically, among other things. First is a reduction in corporate tax and personal income taxes. Second is what I would refer to as trade protection. And third is infrastructure spending. Hardly a purely conservative point of view when it comes to economics. So first, let's talk about taxes. It is true that U.S. corporate taxes are probably the highest in the world, if not the highest, at 35%. 35% used to be competitive, but many countries have lowered their corporate taxes. He wants to cut it to 15%, so they want to reduce it by more than half. Now, that's a vast simplification of a complicated legislative problem because there are several Republican corporate tax plans to consider, and they have to be harmonized with trade agreements and the world trade situation. So in order to actually be legal, believe it or not. So just saying we're going to do this doesn't necessarily mean that we will be doing it. And as I said on last week's show, when it comes to middle class tax cutting, the middle class tax burden is actually historically low. The expectation that 2016 is just like 1980 and Trump will, he's just like Reagan, he'll do what Reagan did, is really just Pollyanna. It's state and payroll taxes that the middle class pays a lot of collectively, and these will not be affected by any proposals from the White House after Trump moves in. So basically, he has proposed three tax brackets, and I don't know whether this is the Paul Ryan plan or whether this is his plan or some hybrid, but this is basically the trend of the conversation. 12%, 25%, and 33%. He would repeal the alternative minimum tax. He would repeal the estate tax and tax capital gains at death, which Forbes calls highly unusual in that that proposal has not been taken seriously really by anyone. He's also said that he will repeal all taxes associated with Obamacare, including the penalty. But if they leave it in place, I don't know how that works. So that's a question. Another question is whether these measures can pass Congress without tinkering, particularly when it comes to Obamacare, because we've heard them say that they're going to repeal it and replace it. But the question is, what do they replace it with? And on and on and on. And that we don't have enough time in this radio show to really talk about that. I've also read that his tax plans will be collapsed into the Ryan tax plan, which also reduces things to a number like three brackets. But I don't know specifically how that's worked out. We also don't know whether these cuts are going to have any effect on a $13 to $16 trillion economy, because we don't know how much revenue will be produced in the general economy. The idea with tax cutting is it's basically supply side, in that you cut taxes and you grow the economy, and you grow the economy out of budget deficits. So considering budget deficits, entitlements, and deficit spending, there really hasn't been any discussion on permanently cutting spending, because the way that you're really supposed to do this is you're supposed to cut taxes and and cut spending at the same time. And if we go back to the 1980s, it's probably the Contract for America and really limiting spending during the second Reagan administration that probably had the most effect on improving the economy, as well as limiting regulation and things of that nature. I don't hear too much conversation about limiting the power of the federal government permanently and thus reducing spending permanently. What I have heard is Trump's going to spend trillions of dollars on infrastructure. He said it just a couple days ago when he was doing the rally down in the Carolinas. God knows how much the military is going to take to make it stronger than it's ever been at any time in our history. That was another quote. And I got to tell you, I've driven the whole country. We do not have an infrastructure problem in the United States. The roads are not broken down. The bridges are not falling down. You can refer to the 35W bridge in Minneapolis all the time. That was a design failure and not an infrastructure decay problem. We have heavily trafficked airports. Some of them are worn, but most of them are pretty nice. Minneapolis and St. Paul looks pretty good. Indianapolis is a brand new airport. Newark still looks okay. Washington, D.C., and so on. Now, everybody has their favorite and least favorite airports, but I don't know that I would say that they're falling apart and look like they're from the third world. But when was the last time Trump flew coach? When was the last time he took a 757 into a passenger terminal? So I don't know how he knows that they're falling down. What he's talking about is LaGuardia, which has been a disaster for years. And LaGuardia is kind of one of these airports that's been cobbled together over the years from what it was back in the day. The other thing is trade protection, and I call it trade protection because that's what it is. Yeah, he got some more jobs for the people at Carrier. He got more jobs in Indiana because he made a deal for tax benefits with Carrier. But how many times can you do that over and over again? How many times should you penalize American companies for seeking the lowest production cost? Because that is, after all, what capitalism is. Essentially, if you require higher costs by requiring companies to do business here, you are going to lower productivity and you're going to increase prices and you're going to price things out of the market. Infrastructure spending in particular is a problem because the federal government has to block grant to the states who actually spend the money on airports and bridges and roads. And usually what happens is the money gets held up, it gets reallocated or bottlenecked, and it doesn't have what's called a high multiple. And this is what happened with Barack Obama's trillion-dollar infrastructure plan, and it could happen as well with Trump's. The other thing is demanding companies do business in the U.S. may not be a good idea, because what has happened is U.S. labor has priced itself out of the market. And even when we add jobs, we still have trouble finding machinists and skilled laborers in the United States. So now you're at odds with the immigration program. It is true that defense spending has a higher multiple. This is the one area, and this is the reason, I think, because the federal government spends directly on defense. If it is spent on new technology and development and not oil for Humvees or, you know, new latrines, you can conceivably get a higher multiple out of that. But at the end of the day, where does all this money come from? It comes from taxes. It comes from borrowing. So tax cutting may be supply side, but supply side isn't taking money from the deep end of the pool and pouring it into the shallow side to make that part of the pool deeper. Trade protection, deficit spending, tax cutting actually is President Hoover's economic policy, not necessarily Reagan's. Now, in my opinion, if he does all these things, what we will see is things will get better for a while, but we still haven't addressed the primary concerns, which in my opinion, and which I think from the so-called conservative side, don't even get me started with labels, but we're supposed to be concerned about government power, and specifically federal government power. Things like spending and entitlements, things like infrastructure, only add to the spending and the bureaucrats and make government stronger. You're supposed to be draining the swamp, right? You don't do that by spending more. What we do with a stronger and more potent military is also an issue, because starting a war with a stronger and more potent military could end up costing us a lot more than what we think in the short term. Think LBJ in Vietnam, or most recently Bush in Iraq and Afghanistan. Doesn't mean I'm saying it's going to be like that with Trump, but you may feel better about things in 6 months, but you might not feel better about things in 2 years, which is going to be critical for Republican victories if you're interested in that in 2018 and 2020. One of the best reasons for things like infrastructure development and spending is that the president can dole out cash to states to make them do things he wants them to do. There's a big story in the Village Voice this weekend about how the governor of New York is salivating at the prospect of infrastructure dollars in that state. And Trump can use this to beat up mayors and governors who won't play by his rules. For example, sanctuary cities. Keep in mind, you're already, dealing with people like the mayor of Los Angeles, who is channeling changes to policy. So L.A. doesn't necessarily look like a sanctuary city, but it still is, just to make sure that there's a flow of federal dollars to the city of angels. Doesn't matter what your expectations are. We still have a federal government and state governments that play games with tax rates, doling out benefits and penalties to the people they like and dislike, or to encourage certain behaviors. And this is really the problem. So while we're arguing about fake news and the Electoral College, what they're doing is literally looting the Treasury and borrowing on our futures to buy votes. That's what's really going on with all these governments. And that's the thing that really needs to be addressed. So, go ahead, keep thinking that Trump's going to fix everything because he was going to be so much better than Clinton. You could be right. More than likely, I'm not expecting that there will be a lot of difference between one or the other in a few years. Could I be wrong? Well, I actually really hope that I am wrong and that he ends up being a fabulous president. I don't know that that's for sure going to happen. That's going to do it for this week's Bob Davis Podcasts radio show. Boop. This is the Bob Davis Podcasts radio show. Very superstitious. Well, thanks again to Ryan Plumbing and Heating of St. Paul for sponsoring the Bob Davis Podcasts. Because of steady growth, Ryan really needs plumbers, pipe fitters, sheet metal workers, HVAC control specialists. Once again, they've had steady growth at Ryan Plumbing and Heating. They've been around for four generations. Wherever you are in the metro, really, wherever you hear this podcast, wherever you are in America, Ryan is interested if you've got those skills. And all you have to do is call Ryan, 612-927-6488 in Minneapolis, in St. Paul, 651-224-4771, online, ryanplumbing.com. And thanks again to Brush Studio in the West End in St. Louis Park. You can reach out to Brush at 952-236-1700, 952-236-1700. Click on the banner at the top of the Bob Davis Podcast page to find out more about Brush Studio, or you can just reach out to them online at brushstudio.net. Really appreciate the subscriptions, the you subscribers at iTunes and TuneIn and Stitcher.com. And thanks for liking and sharing and favoriting and following on social media, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. And thanks for your donations for mobile podcast command at the BobDavisPodcast.com. Yes, if we have a constitutional crisis, I will be heading out to Washington. I don't think that that's probably going to happen, but just in case, mobile podcast command is standing by just in case. Thanks for listening to podcast 580, the Bob Davis Podcast.